mortalizes them. No matter when it happens, we all have our endings. No one goes on. But what we leave behind keeps us alive for someone else. And I look at this crowded room of people, Deckers and friends, and they are all living. A hand closes on mine, and it's not the same one that grabbed mine less than an hour ago. This hand carries history. The hand I held when my goddaughter was born, and the many mornings and evenings after Christian died. Traveling that world within a world with Lydia was incredible, and having her here in this moment, a moment I couldn't buy, makes me happy despite every reason to be down. Rufus comes up beside me and wraps an arm around my shoulders. "The floor is yours," Rufus says. "The stage, too, when you're game." "I'm getting there," I say. "I have to get there." On stage, there's a teenager on crutches singing "Can't Fight This Feeling." And, as Rufus would say, he's absolutely killing it. There are a couple of people dancing behind him. Friends, strangers, who knows, who cares. And this energy elevates me. I guess I could call this energy freedom. No one will be around to judge me tomorrow. No one will send messages to friends about the lame kid who had no rhythm. And in this moment, how stupid it was to care hits me like a punch to the face. I wasted time and missed fun because I cared about the wrong things.
"Got a song in mind?"
"Nope," I say. "There are plenty of songs I love. Vienna by Billy Joel, Tomorrow Tomorrow by Elliott Smith, Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen is one of Dad's favorites. All these songs have notes I have no chance of hitting, but that's not what's stopping me. I just want the song to be right." The menu above the bar is illustrated with a skull and crossbones, and it's striking to see the skull smiling. "Last Day to Smile," it reads. The drinks are all alcohol-free, which makes sense since dying isn't an excuse to sell alcohol to minors. There was a huge debate a couple years ago about whether or not Deckers 18 and up should be allowed to purchase drinks. When lawyers presented percentages about teenagers dying from alcohol poisoning and drunk driving, it was ruled things would remain as they have been. Legally. It's still really easy to get liquor and beer, is my understanding. Always has been, always will be. "Let's grab a drink," I say. We push past the crowd, strangers dancing against us as we try to clear a path. The DJ calls up a bearded guy named David to the stage. David rolls onto the stage and announces he's singing "A Fond Farewell" by Elliott Smith. I don't know if he's a Decker or singing for a friend, but it's beautiful. We reach the bar. I'm not in the mood for a grapeyard mocktail. Definitely not Death's Spring. Lydia orders a Terminator, this ruby-red mocktail. They serve her quickly. She takes a sip, scrunching her face like she's eaten a handful of sour candy. "Do you want?" "I'm good," I say.
"I wish this had some kick to it," Lydia says. "I can't be sober when I lose you."
Rufus orders a soda, and I do the same. Once we have our drinks, I raise my glass. "To smiling while we can." We clink glasses, and Lydia is biting her quivering lower lip, while Rufus, like me, is smiling. Rufus cuts through our circle, and he's so close his shoulder is pressed against mine. He talks directly into my ear, since the music and cheers are so loud.
"This is your night, Mateo. Seriously. You sang to your dad earlier and stopped when I came in. No one is judging you. You're holding yourself back, and you have to go for it."
That David guy finishes his song and everyone applauds. And it's not some faint applause either. You would think there's a rock legend performing up there.
"See? They just want to see you having fun, living it up."
I smile and lean into his ear. "You have to sing with me. You choose the song. Rufus nods and his head leans against mine.
Okay, American Pie. Can we make that happen?
I love that song.
It's happening.
I ask Lydia to watch our drinks as Rufus and I run up to put in a request with the DJ. Before we reach the DJ, a Turkish girl named Jasmine sings Because the Night by Patti Smith. And it's amazing how someone so tiny can demand such attention and ignite this level of excitement. A brunette girl with a wide smile, a smile you don't expect to find on someone dying, requests a song and steps away. I tell DJ Luau our song and he compliments our choice. I sway a little to Jasmine's performance, bopping my head when I feel it's appropriate. Rufus is smiling, watching me. And I stop, embarrassed. I shrug and pick it all up again. I like being visible this time. The time of my life, Rufus, I say. I'm having it. Right now.
Me too, dude. Thanks for reaching out to me over Last Friend, Rufus says.
Thanks for being the best last friend a closet case could ask for. The brunette from earlier, Becky, is called to the stage, and she performs Otis Redding's Try a Little Tenderness. We're next in the queue, and we wait by the stage's sticky steps. When Becky's song is reaching its close, the nerves finally hit me. The nextness of it all. But nothing prepares me for the moment when DJ Luau says, Rufus and Matthew to the stage! Yes, he gets my name wrong. Much like Andrea from Deathcast so many hours ago, it feels like it could have been a different day. I've lived a lifetime today, and this moment is my encore. Rufus rushes up the steps, and I chase after him. Becky wishes me luck with the sweetest smile. I pray she's not a Decker. And if she is, I hope she passes without any regrets. I shout back, Great job, Becky! Before turning around. Rufus drags two stools center stage for our pretty lengthy song. Good call, because my knees are trembling as I walk across the stage, spotlight in my eyes and a buzzing in my ears. I sit down beside him, and DJ Luau sends someone over to hand us microphones, which makes me feel mighty, like I've been handed Excalibur in a battle my army was losing. American Pie begins to play, and the crowd cheers, like it's our own song, like they know who we are. Rufus squeezes my hand and lets go.
A long, long time ago, Rufus begins. I can still remember.
How that music used to make me smile. I join in. My eyes are tearing up. My face is warm. No, hot. I find Lydia swaying. A dream couldn't possibly capture the intensity of this moment. This'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. The energy in the room changes. Not just my confidence, despite how off-key I am. No, our words are actually connecting with the Deckers in the audience, sinking deep past their skin and into their souls, which are fading, like a firefly turning off, but still very present. Some Deckers sing along, and I'm sure if they were allowed to have lighters in here, they'd whip them out. Some are crying, others are smiling with closed eyes, hopefully lost in good memories. For 8 minutes, Rufus and I sing about a thorny crown, whiskey and rye, a generation lost in space, Satan's spell, a girl who sang the blues, the day the music died, and so much more. The song ends, I catch my breath, and I breathe in everyone's roaring applause. I breathe in their love, and it energizes me to grab Rufus's hand while he's bowing. I drag him off stage, and once we're behind the curtain, I look him in the eyes, and he smiles like he knows what's about to go down. And he's not wrong. I kiss the guy who brought me to life on the day we're going to die.
Finally,
Rufus says when I give him the chance to breathe, and now he kisses me.
What took you so long?
I know. I'm sorry. I know there's no time to waste, but I had to be sure you are who I thought you were. The best thing about dying is your friendship. I never thought I would find someone I could say words like this to. They're so broad, yet deeply personal. And it's a private thing I want to share with everyone. And I think this is that feeling we all chase. And even if I never got to kiss you, you gave me the life I always wanted.
You took care of me too, Rufus says. I've been so damn lost the past few months, especially last night. I hated all the doubts and being so pissed off. But you gave me the best assist ever and helped me find myself again. You made me better, yo.
I'm ready to kiss him again when his eyes move away from mine, beyond the stage and into the audience. He squeezes my arm. Rufus's smile is brighter. The Plutos are here.
Howie Maldonado, 5:23 p.m. Deathcast called Howie Maldonado at 2:37 a.m. to tell him he's going to die today. His 2.3 million Twitter followers are taking it the hardest. For the greater part of the day, Howie stayed in his hotel room with a team of security guards outside his door, all armed. Fame gave him this life, but it won't keep him alive. The only people allowed inside his hotel room were his lawyers, who needed wills created, and his literary agent, who needed his next contract signed before Howie could kick it. Funny how a book he didn't write has more of a future than he does. Howie answered phone calls from co-stars, his little cousin whose popularity in school is tied to Howie's success, more lawyers, and his parents. Howie's parents live in Puerto Rico, where they moved back after Howie's career took off. Howie desperately wanted them to remain in Los Angeles, where he lives now, offering to take care of every last bill and splurge. But his parents' love for San Juan, where they first met, was too great. Howie can't help but be bothered by the fact that his parents, while clearly devastated, are going to be fine without him. They've already grown used to living without him, to watching his life from afar, like fans, like strangers. Howie is currently in a car with more strangers, two women from Infinite Weekly, for a final interview. He's only doing this for the fans. Howie knows he could have lived another 10 years and everything he shares about himself would have never been enough. They're ravenous for content, as his publicists and managers say. Every haircut, every new magazine cover, every tweet, no matter how many typos. Howie's tweet last night was a picture of his dinner. He's already sent out one last tweet. Thank you for this life. Attached is a photo taken by himself, smiling. Who are you on your way to see? The older woman asks. Sandy, he believes. Yes, Sandy. Not Sally, like his very first publicist. Sandy. Is this part of the interview? Howie asks. Whenever he does these pieces, his answers require zero focus. So he normally hops on his phone and scrolls through Twitter and Instagram. But keeping up with the outpouring of love, including messages from the author of the Scorpius Hawthorne series, is 10 times more impossible than usual. It could be, Sandy says. She lifts the tape recorder. Your call. Howie wishes his publicist were here with him to shut down this question herself. But he wrote her a big check, had it sent down to her hotel room, and encouraged her to stay far away from him, as if he were infected with a zombie virus. Pass, Howie says. It's no one's business that he's on his way to see his childhood best friend and first love, Lena, who's flown in from Arkansas to see him one last time. The girl who could have been more than a friend if he didn't live in the spotlight. The girl he'd once missed so much he'd write her name around the city, like on payphones and coffee tables, never signing his name. The girl who loves the quiet life her husband gives her. "Very well," Sandy says. "What's your proudest accomplishment?" "My art," Howie says, fighting back an eye roll. The other woman, Delilah, stares at him like she's seeing past his bullshit. Howie would be intimidated if he wasn't busy being distracted by her beautiful hair, which resembles the northern lights, and the fresh bandage on her forehead, which is covering up a Scorpius Hawthorne-like wound. "Where do you think you would be without the draconian marsh roll?" Sandy asks. "Literally? Back in San Juan, with my parents. Professionally? Who can say?" "Better question," Delilah speaks up. Sandy is pissed, and Delilah speaks over her. "What do you regret?" "Excuse her," Sandy says. "I'm firing her, and she's getting out at the next red light." Howie turns his attention to Delilah. "I love what I did, but I don't know who I am beyond the voice of a Twitter account and the evil face for a franchise." "What would you have done differently?" Delilah asks. "I probably wouldn't have done that shitty college bait film." Howie smiles, surprised by his own humor on his last day ever. "I would have only done what meant a lot to me, like the Scorpius films. That adaptation was one of a kind. But I should have used those fortunes to spend time with the people who mean a lot to me. Family and friends. I got caught up reinventing myself so I could land different roles and not be the evil wizard kid. For fuck's sake, I'm in town to meet a publisher for another book I didn't write." Delilah eyes the copy of Howie's book, unsigned, sitting between her and her boss. Former boss, it's unclear. "What would have made you happy?" Delilah asks. Love comes to mind immediately, and it surprises him like a lightning bolt on a day with clear forecasts. Howie never felt lonely, because he could go online at any moment and find himself flooded with messages. But affection from millions and intimacy from that one special person are completely different beasts. "My life is a double-edged sword," Howie says, not speaking of his life as if it's already over, as other defeated Deckers do. "I am where I am because my life moved as fast as it did. If I didn't land that gig, maybe I would be in love with someone who loves me back. Maybe I would have been an actual son, and not someone who thought being a bank account was enough. I could have taken time to learn Spanish so I could speak with my grandma without my mom translating." "If you weren't successful and had all those things instead, would that have been enough for you?" Delilah asks. She's sitting at the edge of her seat. Sandy is invested, too.
"I think so."
Howie shuts up as Delilah's and Sandy's eyes widen. The car jerks, and Howie closes his eyes, a deep sinking in his chest, like every time he's been on a roller coaster, scaling higher and higher past the point of no return, and he's falling at incredible speed. Except Howie knows he's not safe. The Gang with No Name. 5:36 p.m. Deathcast did not call this gang of boys today, and they're living as if this means their lives can't be over while they're alive. They run through the streets, not caring about traffic, as if they're invincible against speeding cars and completely untouchable by the law. Two boys laugh when one car bangs into another, spinning out of control until it crashes against the wall. The third is too focused on reaching his target and pulling the handgun out of his backpack. Delilah Gray, 5:37 p.m. Delilah is still alive. She doesn't have to test Howie's pulse to know he isn't. She saw the way his head banged against the reinforced window, heard the sickening crack that will stay with her forever. Her heartbeat runs wild. In a single day, the same day when she received a call informing her she will die today, Delilah has not only survived an explosion by a bookstore, but also a car accident caused by three boys running through the street. If Death wanted her, Death had two shots. Delilah and Death won't be meeting today.
Rufus, 5:39 p.m. I want to keep holding Mateo's hand, but I gotta hug my people. I move through the crowd, pushing Deckers and others aside to get to the Plutos. We all hit pause on ourselves and press play at the exact same second, like four cars moving at a green light. We group hug, four Plutos coming together in the Pluto solar system embrace I've been waiting for over 15 hours, ever since I ran out of my own damn funeral. I love you guys, I say. No one cracks homo jokes. We're past that. They shouldn't be here. But taking risks is the name of the game today, and I'm playing it. You don't smell like prison, Tego. You should see my new ink, Tego says. We've seen shit. We didn't see shit, Malcolm says. You guys ain't shit, I say. Not even house arrest, Amy says. Damn shame. We pull apart, but stay really close, as if the crowd is forcing us to squeeze up against each other. They're all staring at me. Tego looks like he wants to pet me. Malcolm looks like he's seeing a ghost. Amy looks like she wants another hug. I don't let Tego treat me like a dog or shout boo at Malcolm, but I move in and hug the hell out of Amy. My bad, Ames, I say. I didn't know I was sorry until I saw her face. I shouldn't have shut you out like that. Not on a damn end day. I'm sorry too, Amy says. There's only one side that matters to me, and I'm sorry I was trying to play both. We didn't have nearly as much time as we should have, but you'll always be more important. Even after. Thanks for saying that, I say. I'm sorry I had to say something so obvious, Amy says. We're all good, I say. I know I helped Mateo live his life, but he helped me get mine back in shape. I want to be remembered as who I am right now. Not for that dumbass mistake I made. I turn, and Mateo and Lydia are standing shoulder to shoulder. I pull him over by his elbow. This is my last friend, Mateo, I say. And this is his number one, Lydia. The Plutos shake hands with Mateo and Lydia. Solar systems are colliding. Are you scared? Amy asks us both. I grab Mateo's hand and nod. It'll be game over, but we won first. Thanks for taking care of our boy, Malcolm says. You're both honorary Plutos, Tego says. He turns to Malcolm and Amy. We should get badges made. I give the Plutos a beat-by-beat play of my end day, and I fill them in on how color found its way to my Instagram. Elastic Heart by Sia comes to an end. We should be out there, right? Amy says, nodding toward the dance floor. Let's do this. Mateo says it before I can.
Mateo, 5:48 p.m. I grab Rufus's hand and drag him to the dance floor right as a young black guy named Chris takes the stage. Chris says he's about to perform an original song called The End. He raps about final goodbyes, nightmares we want to wake up from, and the inevitable squeeze of death. If I weren't standing here with Rufus and our favorite people, I would be depressed. But instead we're all dancing, Something else I never thought I would get to do. Not just dancing, but dancing with someone who challenges me to live. The beat pulses through me, and I follow the lead of others, bopping my head and bouncing my shoulders. Rufus does a mock Harlem shake to either impress me or make me laugh, and it works on both counts, mainly because his confidence is glowing and admirable. We close the space between us, our hands still very much to our sides or in the air, but we're dancing against each other. Not always in sync, but who cares? We remain pressed together as more people flood the dance floor. Yesterday, Mateo would have found this claustrophobic, but now? Don't ever move me. The song changes, and now it's super fast. But Rufus stills me and puts a hand on my hip. Dance with me. I thought we were dancing already. Am I doing it wrong? You're great. I meant a slow dance. The beat has only increased, but we place our hands on each other's shoulders and waist. My fingers dig into him a little. The first time I'm getting to touch someone else like this. We take it slow. And out of all the ways I've lived today, maintaining eye contact with Rufus is really hard. It's easily become the most intense intimacy I've ever experienced. He leans into my ear, throwing me into this weird phase where I'm relieved to be free of his gaze, but also miss his eyes and the way he looks at me, like I'm good enough. And Rufus says, I wish we had more time. I want to ride bikes through empty streets and spend $100 at an arcade and take the Staten Island ferry just to introduce you to my favorite snow cones. I lean into his ear. I want to go to Jones Beach and race you to the waves and play in the rain with our friends. But I want quiet nights, too, where we talk about nonsense while watching bad movies. I want us to have history, something longer than the small window of time we're actually sharing, with an even longer future. But the dying elephant in the room crushes me. I rest my forehead against his, the both of us sweating. I have to talk to Lydia. I kiss Rufus again before we break through the crowd. He grabs my hand from behind, following me through the path I'm clearing. Lydia sees us holding hands right as Rufus lets go, and I take hers in mine, leading her toward the bathrooms, where it's a little quieter. Don't slap me, I say, but I'm obviously into Rufus, and he's into me, and I'm sorry for never telling you someone like Rufus is someone I would be into. I thought I had more time to accept myself, you know? Even though I'd never really saw anything ugly or wrong about it. I think I was waiting around for a reason. Something beautiful and awesome to accompany any declaration. It's Rufus. Lydia raises her hand. I still want to slap you, Mateo Torres. She wraps her arms around me instead. I don't know this Rufus character, and I'm not sure how well you know him either after one day, but I don't know every detail about his past, but what I've gotten out of him in one day is more than I feel like I ever deserved. I don't know if that makes sense. What am I going to do without you? This loaded question is the reason I didn't want anyone to know I was dying. There are questions I can't answer. I cannot tell you how you will survive without me. I cannot tell you how to mourn me. I cannot convince you to not feel guilty if you forget the anniversary of my death, or if you realize days or weeks or months have gone by without thinking about me. I just want you to live. On the wall, there are markers of many colors, most of them dried out, hanging from rubber cords. I find a bold orange marker that works, and I tiptoe to reach this blank space where I write, Mateo was here, and Lydia was by his side, as always. I hug Lydia. Promise me you'll be okay. It would be a huge lie. Please lie to me, I say. Come on, tell me you'll keep moving. Penny needs you at 100%, and I need to know you'll be strong enough to take care of the future global leader. Damn it, I can't, Something is wrong, I say. My heart is pounding. Amy is standing between Rufus and the Plutos, and three guys who are yelling over her. Lydia grabs my hand, like she's trying to drag me backward a bit, to save my life before I can get caught up in this. She's scared she's going to have to watch me die, and I am too. The shorter guy with the bruised face pulls out a gun. Who could want to kill Rufus like this? The guy he jumped. Everyone notices the gun, and pandemonium rages in the club. I run toward Rufus, guests charging into me as they run for the door. I get knocked down, and people are stepping on me, and this is how I'm going to die. A minute before Rufus gets shot to death, maybe even the same minute, Lydia is screaming at everyone to stop and back off, and she's helping me up. There haven't been any gunshots yet, but everyone is steering clear of the circle. This stampede is impossible to get through, and I can't reach Rufus, and I'm not going to be able to touch him again while he's still alive.
Rufus, 5:59 p.m. I want to get at Amy, thinking she led him here, but she's standing between me and his gun. I know she's not going to die today, but that don't make her bulletproof. I don't know how Peck knew to find me here, with his goons and a gun, but this is it for me. I can't be stupid. I can't be a hero. I don't want to make peace with this. Maybe if I had a gun pointed at me before I met Mateo and got my Plutos back. Yeah, whatever. Pull the trigger. But my life is stepping its game up. You're not talking shit now, huh? Peck asks. His hand is shaking.
Don't do this. Please.
Amy shakes her head.
This will end your life, too.
You begging for him, right? You don't give a shit about me?
I will never give a shit about you if you do this.
She better not be saying this just to calm him down, because I will haunt the hell out of these two if they actually stay together. I want to take my shot at hiding behind Malcolm for a second and dashing toward Peck, but that's not going to get me far. Mateo. He's coming up behind Peck, and I shake my head at him, which Peck sees. Peck turns, and I run at him because Mateo's life is threatened. Mateo punches Peck in the face, which is straight unbelievable. And it doesn't send Peck to the floor or nothing like that, but we got a chance now. Peck's homie swings at Mateo and is about to rock his head off his shoulders, but he pulls back at the last second, like he recognizes him. I don't know, but Mateo finally steps back. Peck lunges for Mateo, and I charge at him, but Malcolm beats me to it, running into Peck and his boy like a train, carrying them through the air as the gun drops, and he slams them against the wall. The gun doesn't go off. We all good. Peck's other boy goes for the gun, and I kick him in the face as he goes to grab it, and Tego jumps on top of him. I grab the gun. I can try and end Peck for good and keep Amy safe from him. I point the gun at him as Malcolm clears away. Mateo is looking at me the way he did when I caught up with him, after he ran away from me. Like I'm dangerous. I unload the gun. All the bullets find their way into the wall. I grab Mateo and we jet because Peck and his people are here to kill, and we are the ones most likely to find a knife in our necks or bullets in our heads. This day is doing me dirty on goodbyes.
Dalma Young, 6:20 p.m. Deathcast did not call Dalma Young because she isn't dying today, but if they had, she would have spent the day with her half-sister and maybe even a last friend. She created the app, after all. I promise you don't want to work for me, Dalma says, her arm interlocked with her half-sister's as they cross the street. I don't want to work for me. This job has become such a job. But this internship is so stupid,
Dahlia says. If I'm gonna work this hard in tech, I might as well get paid triple what I'm receiving now. Dahlia is the most impatient 20-year-old in New York. She refuses to slow down and is always ready to move from one phase of her life to the next. When she started dating her last girlfriend, she brought up getting married within a week, and now she wants to turn her tech internship into a last friend job. Whatever, how did the meetings go? Did you get to meet Mark Zuckerberg? Meetings went really well, Dahlia says. Twitter may launch the feature as soon as next month. Facebook may need a little more time. Dahlia is in town meeting with developers from both Twitter and Facebook. This morning, she pitched a new last message feature that will allow respective users to prepare their final tweets slash statuses so their online legacy is more meaningful than, say, their thoughts on a popular movie or some viral video of someone else's dog. What do you think your last message would be? Dahlia asks. I'll probably go with that Moulin Rouge quote about how the greatest thing in the world is to love and be loved in return and yada blah whatever. Yeah, you seem truly passionate about that quote, sis, Dahlia says. Dahlia has given thought to this question, of course. Last Friend has been an incredible resource over the past 2 years, since its prototype stage, but she'll forever be horrified by the 11 Last Friend serial killings last summer. She was tempted to sell the app, wash the blood from her hands, but there have been so many instances where the app has done good. Like this afternoon on the train, when she overheard a conversation between two young women, smiling at each other when one said she was so grateful she reached out over Last Friend, and learning the other loves the movement so much, she tags the city with graffiti to promote the app. Her app. Before Dahlia can answer, two teen boys run past her, one with a buzz cut, brown complexion, shades lighter than her own, and another with glasses, fuller brown hair, and light tan skin like Dahlia's. The first teen trips, the other helping him up, and they take off again, who knows where. She wonders if they're half-siblings with only a mother in common, too. Maybe they're lifelong friends, constantly up to no good and constantly lifting each other up. Maybe they've just met. Dahlia watches the teens run off. My last message would be to find your people and to treat each day like a lifetime.
Mateo, 6:24 p.m. We're in the clear, sinking against a wall, like earlier when I was breaking down after running away from Lydia's. I want to be somewhere safe, like a locked room, not out here where people can hunt down Rufus. Rufus holds my hand and wraps his arm around my shoulders, holding me close. Props on punching Peck, Rufus says. First time I've ever hit anyone, I say. I'm still in shock from all my firsts. Singing in public, kissing Rufus, dancing, punching someone, hearing bullets that close. Though you really shouldn't punch people with guns, Rufus says. You could have gotten yourself killed. I stare out into the street, still trying to catch my breath. Are you criticizing how I saved your life? I could have turned around and you would have been dead. I'm not having that. I have no regrets. I go back in time and imagine myself being a little slower, maybe tripping, and losing valuable time and losing my valuable friend as bullets rip apart his beautiful heart. I almost lost Rufus. We have less than 6 hours left, and if he goes first, I'll be a zombie who's well aware his head is on the chopping block. The connection I have with Rufus isn't what I expected when I met him around 3 in the morning. This day is unimaginably rewarding and still so, so impossible. I'm tearing up, and there's no stopping there. I finally cry because I want more mornings. I miss everyone. I say, Lydia, The Plutos? Me too, Rufus says. But we can't risk their lives again. I nod. The suspense of everything is killing me. I can't take being out here. My chest is tight. There's a huge difference between living fearlessly, like I've finally been doing, and knowing you have something to fear while you're out living. Will you hate me if I want to go home? I want to rest in my bed where everything is safe, and I want you to come with me, but inside this time. I know I spent my life hiding there, but I did my best to live, too, and I want to share this place with you. Rufus squeezes my hand. Take me home, Mateo.
The Plutos, 6:33 p.m. Deathcast did not call these three Plutos because they aren't dying today, but their fourth did receive the alert, and that's just as devastating. The Plutos almost witnessed the death of their best friend, Rufus, as a gun was pulled on him. Rufus's last friend appeared out of nowhere like a superhero and punched Peck in the face, saving Rufus's life, for a little while longer at least. The Plutos know Rufus won't survive the day, but they didn't lose him to a violent act from someone who had it out for him. The Plutos stand together on the curb outside Clint's graveyard as a cop car speeds off down the street, taking the gang with no name away. The two boys cheer and hope they spend more time behind bars than they did today. The girl regrets her role in all of this, but she's relieved her insecure, jealous boyfriend didn't deliver the killing blow. Ex-boyfriend. While they're not facing death themselves, tomorrow everything changes for the Plutos. They will have to restart something they've grown used to doing. Their youth is packed with more history than most teens their age. The death of their friend, however it unfolds, will stay with them forever. Entire lives aren't lessons, but there are lessons in lives. You may be born into a family, but you walk into friendships. Some you'll discover you should put behind you. Others are worth every risk. The three friends hug. A planet missing from their Pluto solar system, but never forgotten.
Rufus, 7:17 p.m. We passed the plot where Mateo buried that bird this morning, back when I was still a stranger on a bike. We should be freaking out big time, because we're going to be on our way out soon, too, like old meat. But I'm keeping it together by Mateo's side, and he seems chill, too. Mateo leads the way into his building. If there's nothing else you want to do, Roof, I thought we could visit my dad again. You just call me Roof? Mateo nods, and his face scrunches up like he's told a bad joke. Thought I would try it out. That okay? Definitely okay, I say. That's a good plan, too. I'm cool with resting for a bit before making that run. Part of me can't help but wonder if Mateo is bringing me home so we can have sex, but it's probably safe to assume sex isn't on the brain for him. Mateo is about to press the elevator button until he remembers we're not about that, especially not this late in the game. He opens the stairwell door and cautiously goes up. The silence is mad heavy between us. Step by step. Wish I could challenge him to a race to his apartment, like he imagined for us at Jones Beach. But that's a surefire way to never actually reach the apartment. I miss... Mateo stops on the third floor. I think he's about to bring up his dad, maybe Lydia. I miss when I was so young I didn't know to be afraid of death. I even miss yesterday when I was paranoid and not actually dying. I hug him because that says everything when I actually don't have anything to say. He squeezes me back before we go up the last flight of steps. Mateo unlocks his front door.
I can't believe I'm bringing a boy home for the first time and there's no one here for you to meet. How wild would it be if we go in and his dad is on the couch waiting for him? We go inside, and no one is here except us. I hope not. I tour the living room. Not gonna front. I got myself a little nervous, like some old family friend turned enemy is about to pop out because they figured the place was vulnerable with Mateo's dad in a coma. Everything seems good. I look at Mateo's class photos. There's a bunch of photos of him without glasses. When do you have to get glasses? I ask. Fourth grade. I was only teased for about a week, so I was lucky. Mateo stares at his senior photo, cap and gown, and it's like he's looking at a mirror and finding some sci-fi alternate universe version of himself. I should capture it on camera because it's dope, but the look on his face only makes me want to hug him again. I bet I disappointed my dad by signing up for online classes. He was so proud of me when I graduated, and I'm sure he was hoping I would change my mind, get off the internet, and have the typical college experience. You'll get to tell him everything you've done, I say. We won't hang around here long. It'll mean a lot to Mateo if we see his dad again. Mateo nods. Follow me. We go down a short hall and into his room. So this is where you've been hiding from me, I say. There are books all over the floor, like someone tried robbing the place. Mateo doesn't seem freaked by it. I wasn't hiding from you. Mateo crouches and puts the books into piles. I had a panic attack earlier. I don't want my dad knowing I was scared when he comes home. I want him to believe I was brave all the way through. I get down on my knees and pick up a book. Is there a system here? Not anymore, Mateo says. We put the books back on his shelves and pick up some little trinkets off the floor. I don't like the idea of you being scared either. It wasn't that bad. Don't worry about old me. I look around his room. There's an Xbox Infinity, a piano, some speakers, a map I pick up off the floor for him. I'm flattening it out with my fist, thinking about all the dope places Mateo and I have been together. When I spot a Luigi hat on the floor between his dresser and bed, I grab the hat and he grins as I put it on his head. There's the guy who hit me up this morning, I say. Luigi? Mateo asks. I laugh and pull out my phone. He doesn't smile for the camera. He's legit just smiling at me. I haven't felt this good about myself since Amy. Photo shoot time. Go jump on your bed or something. Mateo rushes to the bed and leaps, falling face first. He gets up and jumps and jumps, turning to the window quickly, as if some freak bounce accident will launch him out there like a catapult. I don't stop taking photos of this awesome, unrecognizable Mateo.
Mateo, 7:34 p.m. I'm out of character and Rufus is loving it. I'm loving it too. I stop bouncing and stay seated at the edge of the bed, trying to catch my breath. Rufus sits beside me and grabs my hand. I'm going to sing something for you, I say. I don't want to let go of his hand, but I promise myself I'll put both of mine to good use. I sit in front of my keyboard. Get ready. This is a once-in-a-lifetime performance. I look over my shoulder. Feeling special yet? Rufus fakes being unimpressed. I'm feeling okay. A little tired, actually. Well, wake up and feel special. My dad used to sing this for my mother, though his voice is much better than mine. I play the keys for Elton John's Your Song with a pounding heart, though my face isn't as hot as it was back at Clint's graveyard. I'm not kidding when I tell Rufus to feel special. I'm off-key, and I don't care because of him. I sing about a man making potions in a traveling show, how my gift is my song, sitting on the roof, keeping the sun turned on, the sweetest eyes I've ever seen, and so much more. I turn during a quick break and catch Rufus filming me on his phone. I smile his way. He comes over and kisses me on my forehead while I sing with him by my side. I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down in words how wonderful life is now you're in the world. I finish, and Rufus's smile is a victory. He's tearing up. You were hiding from me, Mateo. I always wanted to stumble into someone like you, and it sucks that I had to find you through a stupid app. I like the Last Friend app, I say. I get his sentiment, but I wouldn't change how I met Rufus. There I was, looking for some company, and I found you and you found me. And we chose to meet up because of gut instinct. What would have been the alternative? I can't guarantee I would have ever left here, or that our paths would have crossed. Not with one day left. It would make for a great story, yeah, but I think the app puts you out there more than anything else. For me, it meant admitting I was lonely and wanted to connect with someone. I just wasn't counting on what I have with you. You're right, Mateo Torres. It happens every now and again, Rufus Emeterio. It's the first time I've said his last name out loud, and I hope I've pronounced it right. I go to the kitchen and return with some snacks. It's childish, but we play house. I smear peanut butter on crackers for him, after confirming he's not allergic, and serve them with a glass of iced tea. How was your day, Rufus? The best, he says. Me too, I say. Rufus pats the edge of the bed. Get over here. I sit down beside him, and we get comfortable, linking our arms and legs together. We talk more about our histories, like how whenever he was acting out, his parents would force him to sit in the middle of the room with them, kind of like how my dad would tell me to go take a shower and calm down. He tells me about Olivia, and I tell him about Lydia. Until it stops being about the past. This is our safe space. Our little island. Rufus traces an invisible circle around us. We aren't moving from here. We can't die if we don't move. You got me? Maybe we'll smother each other to death, I say. Better that than whatever the hell is off our island. I take a deep breath. But if for some reason this plan doesn't work, we need to promise to find each other in the afterlife. There has to be an afterlife, Roof, because it's the only thing that makes dying this young fair. Rufus nods. I will make it so easy for you to find me. Neon signs, marching bands. Good, because I might not have my glasses, I say. Not sure if they'll ascend with me. You're positive about a movie theater in the afterlife, but not if you'll have your glasses? Seems like an oversight in your heavenly blueprint. Rufus removes my glasses and puts them on. Wow. Your eyes suck. You taking my glasses isn't helping my case here. My vision is hazy, and I can only make out his skin tone, but none of his features. I bet you look stupid. Let me take a photo. Actually, lean in with me. I can't see anything, but I look straight, squinting, and smile. He puts the glasses back on my face, and I check out the photo. I look like I've just woken up. Rufus wearing my glasses is a welcome intimacy, like we've known each other for so long that this kind of silliness comes easily to us. I wasn't ever counting on this. I would have loved you if we had more time. I spit it out because it's what I'm feeling in this moment, and was feeling the many moments, minutes, and hours before. Maybe I already do. I hope you don't hate me for saying that, but I know I'm happy. People have their timestamps on how long you should know someone before earning the right to say it, but I wouldn't lie to you no matter how little time we have. People waste time and wait for the right moment, and we don't have that luxury. If we had our entire lives ahead of us, I bet you'd get tired of me telling you how much I love you, because I'm positive that's the path we were heading on. But because we're about to die, I want to say it as many times as I want. I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you.
Rufus, 7:54 p.m. Yo, you know damn well I love you too. Man, it actually hurts how much I mean this. I don't talk out of my dick. You know that's not me. I want to kiss him again because he resurrected me. But I'm tight. If I didn't have common sense, if I hadn't fought so hard to be who I am, I would do some dumb shit again and punch something because I'm so pissed. The world is mad cruel. I started my end day beating up someone because he's dating my ex-girlfriend. And now I'm in bed with an awesome dude I haven't known for 24 hours. This sucks. Do you think? Do I think what? 12 hours ago, Mateo would have been nervous asking me a question. He would have done it, but he would have looked away. Now he doesn't break eye contact. I hate to ask it, but it might be on his mind too. Did finding each other kill us? We were going to die before we knew each other, Mateo says. I know. But maybe this is how it was always written in stone, or the stars, or whatever. Two dudes meet, they fall for each other, they die. If this is really our truth, I get to punch whatever wall I want. Don't try and stop me. That's not our story. Mateo squeezes my hands. We're not dying because of love. We were going to die today no matter what. You didn't just keep me alive. You made me live. He climbs into my lap, bringing us closer. He hugs me so hard his heart is beating against my chest. I bet he feels mine. Two dudes met. They fell in love. They lived. That's our story. That's a better story. Ending still needs some work. Forget about the ending, Mateo says in my ear. He pushes his chest away from mine so he can look me in the eye. I doubt the world is in the mood for a miracle. So we know not to expect a happily ever after. I only care about the endings we lived through today. Like how I stopped being someone afraid of the world and the people in it. And I stopped being someone I don't like, I say. You wouldn't have liked me. He's tearing up and smiling. And you wouldn't have waited for me to be brave. Maybe it's better to have gotten it right and been happy for one day, instead of living a lifetime of wrongs. He's right about everything. We rest our heads on his pillows. I'm hoping we die in our sleep. That seems like the best way to go. I kiss my last friend because the world can't be against us if it brought us together.
Mateo, 8:41 p.m. I wake up feeling invincible. I don't check the time because I don't want anything to shatter my survivor spirit. In my head, I'm already in another day. I have beat Deathcast's prediction, the first person in history to do so. I put my glasses back on, kiss Rufus's forehead, and watch him resting. Nervous, I reach for his heart, and I'm relieved it is still beating. He's invincible, too. I climb over Rufus, and I bet he would kill me himself if he caught me leaving our safe island. But I want to introduce him to Dad.